What a week it's been. By my calculations, today is December 83rd, 2020. Because that new year we were all looking forward to a couple of months ago with its fresh start and better days ahead, well, it has not yet begun, has it? We're still waiting, but I'm sure it's coming. Last week, if you watched or listened online, and if you missed that message, I'd encourage you to go back and check it out. Last week, we worked through the story of Jesus healing the man who was blind from birth in John chapter 9. And we focused mainly not on the man, but on the Pharisees who were blind to the sign that was pointing them to Jesus, the light of the world. As Jesus said, those who are blind, they see, but those who think they can see, they're the ones who are actually blind. And today, I want to spend a few minutes considering the man's experience after he was healed by Jesus. And this will launch us then into how Jesus describes himself in the opening passage in John chapter 10. But early on in chapter 9, after Jesus restores his sight, the man progressively comes to a deeper understanding of who Jesus is. First, he says he's a prophet, and then by the end, he's worshiping Jesus as Lord. And in every one of his interactions with his neighbors or with the religious leaders, he's a model of discipleship. He keeps telling his story. I was blind, but now I see. He keeps faithfully pointing to Jesus as the one who restored his sight in the face of mounting skepticism and opposition and even the threat of ostracism. Because the man had a community. He had friends and neighbors who knew him as a blind beggar and then didn't know how to regard him after he was healed. They did helpfully point out to the Pharisees that he was healed, and on the Sabbath, of course. The man had parents who, when the Pharisees brought them in to hopefully testify that the man had never been blind in the first place, thus nullifying the claim of the miracle, they instead validated that, yes, he's been blind since birth. But they also distanced themselves from their son, who would not stop talking about Jesus. They said, stop asking us questions, ask him. He can speak for himself. And they did this because they were afraid of being put out of the synagogue. Because that's what the Pharisees had threatened to do to anyone who dared say that Jesus was the Messiah. And to be put out of the synagogue was way more than just being told they could no longer attend Saturday church. It was a public shunning. It cut the excommunicated off from their social network. The man's parents, under pressure, choose the synagogue, choose their religious and their social community over standing with and for their son. And then there's the way the Pharisees treat him. Not as a beloved member of their community whose healing they celebrate, but rather as a problem they'd rather not have to deal with. If they can't prove that he wasn't really blind, then they wish he had never been healed. It just creates more problems for them. And then when the man articulates the inescapable conclusion that his restored sight is proof positive that Jesus has to be from God and that Jesus is doing the work of God, John says they throw him out, which is likely a shorthand way of saying they put him out of the synagogue. Having Jesus restore his sight and then demonstrating allegiance to Jesus afterward cost this man every one of his vital relationships. He lost his relationship with his community, his neighbors, his parents, and his religious leaders. And in chapter 9, verse 35, after Jesus hears that the man has been ostracized, he's been thrown out by his old community, Jesus does not leave him alone. Instead, he goes to him and he leads him through the final stage of belief that culminates in worship. And then Jesus addresses not only the man, but some of the Pharisees who are there, because the Pharisees are always there. Jesus has something to say to the Pharisees that the man can overhear. And in our Bible translations, there's a hard chapter break after verse 41 in chapter 9. But as we're about to see, what Jesus says in chapter 10 is really just a continuation of what he's already been saying to the Pharisees at the end of chapter 9. So to get a sense of the flow, let's pick it up in chapter 9, verse 39, and then keep reading on into chapter 10. Jesus says, John chapter 9, verse 39, "For judgment I have come into the world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." And some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. Very truly, I tell you, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate, but climbs in by some other way, is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The gatekeeper opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. And when he has brought out all his own, he goes on ahead of them, and his sheep follow him because they know his voice." They will never follow a stranger. In fact, they will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. And Jesus used this figure of speech, but the Pharisees did not, no surprise here, they did not understand what he was telling them. Jesus uses the familiar imagery of a shepherd and his sheep. It was familiar because there were shepherds and sheep scattered all over the countryside. And it was also familiar because throughout the Jewish scriptures, God is described as a shepherd and the people of Israel as the flock. Shepherding is a model for leadership in the Jewish scriptures. Moses was a shepherd before he led Israel out of slavery in Egypt. It's a metaphor for kingship in the Jewish scriptures. David was a shepherd before he became the king of Israel. The long-awaited Messiah, David's descendant, sometimes described by the prophets as a shepherd. Go read Ezekiel 34 if you want to see all of these themes come together in one passage. Just like everything else in the Gospel of John we've been talking about, this shepherding sheep imagery functions on multiple levels. On the surface, this is a direct critique of the way the Pharisees have mistreated the man Jesus healed. Their treatment of him, their expulsion of him, proves they are not his shepherds. But the man who pledges allegiance to Jesus hears and responds to the voice of his true shepherd. And that's what Jesus is talking about in these opening verses in chapter 10. But of course, the Pharisees don't understand. And so Jesus elaborates by describing himself with two different metaphors. He builds on what he's already said in verse 7. He says, "Very truly, I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who have come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep have not listened to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Ancient sheep pens or sheep folds were circular walls of stones, maybe sometimes sticks and brush, with a little opening, a single opening. That's the door. That's the gate. And the sheep would go into that gate, into the sheepfold at night, and find safety and security from predators. And then in the morning, they would exit that gate and find pasture. There was only one legitimate way in and out of the sheepfold. That gate was the key to life and death for the sheep. And Jesus says, I am that gate. As he's been showing us throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus is the unique means through whom God's people find salvation, security, and sustenance. I am the gate, Jesus says. And then he disregards one of the fundamental tenets of composition and rhetoric and mixes his metaphors with another I am statement in verse 11. He says, now I am, not the gate, but I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep. So when he sees the wolf coming, he abandons the sheep and runs away. And then the wolf attacks the flock and scatters it. And the man runs away because he's a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. So Jesus says, I am the gate, but I am also the good shepherd who leads the sheep in and out of the gate. Well, which one is it? Well, it can't be both. One possible explanation is the way some shepherds around the world will lie down across the gate at night to keep the sheep in the fold and the predators out. So the shepherd literally becomes the gate. Now that's a neat and convenient explanation. Admittedly, though, there is no evidence that shepherds in the first century did this or that this is what Jesus had in mind. But boy, does it make for a good sermon. Nevertheless, when Jesus says, I'm the gate and I am the good shepherd, he's making the same fundamental point. He's saying, I'm committed to the well-being of the flock. I'm the one who saves the flock. I'm the one who serves the flock. I'm the one who protects the flock. I'm the one who provides everything the flock needs. And Jesus says he does it in a way that no other shepherd can. What is on one level a direct, specific critique of the Pharisees' shepherding leadership style or lack thereof with the man Jesus has healed is on a much broader and deeper level a critique of all other would-be shepherd kings and leaders. It's a critique of the other religious leaders in Jerusalem, like the chief priests who are consumed with preserving their power. It's a critique of the messianic pretenders who would take the stage from time to time and rally a crowd and then lead them to their inevitable slaughter. It's a critique of puppet kings like Herod who enhanced his status and his reputation at the expense of the vulnerable and the weak. They're the thieves and the robbers and the bandits who destroy the flock. They're the hired hands who care more about themselves than their flock. Reminds me of the story, the first century Roman senator named Crucius who fled to the tropical Roman province of Kunkan during a massive winter storm and a power outage. Okay, maybe not. Too easy, too obvious. Not irrelevant, though, is it? What makes Jesus the good shepherd? The ideal shepherd? What sets Jesus apart from all the others? He says, I will lay down my life for my sheep. I won't run away like the hired hand does. I will put myself in between the wolf and my flock. I will put the needs of my sheep above my own. I will sacrifice myself for my sheep. When I was in grad school, I had to do an all-night-long ride-along with an Abilene policeman as part of a project for a class. And as the policeman and I were getting acquainted at the beginning of our shift together, he laid out some of the ground rules we would follow. And one of the things he said is, if for some reason, it's probably not going to happen, but if for some reason we get in trouble, we're under attack, or we come under fire, my first priority, and I expect him to say, my first priority is to take care of you. He says, my first priority is to secure myself. And I was like, wait a second, that doesn't sound right. But then he said, because if I'm not alive, I can't protect you. Which made a bit more sense. It's the old put on your oxygen mask first principle. Take care of yourself first so that you can take care of others. But it does raise a question. How can a shepherd who lays down his life protect his flock? What good is a dead shepherd to his vulnerable sheep? And the answer, of course, is that Jesus, the good shepherd, doesn't stay dead. He goes on to say in chapter 10, verse 17, I lay down my life and then I take it up again. So this isn't just a teaching about shepherding and leadership styles. Now, on an even deeper level, this is a teaching about his coming death and resurrection and how he will overcome and defeat on our behalf death, the ultimate wolf, the ultimate predator. Now imagine that you are that man Jesus has healed. And while he's critiquing the Pharisees and other religious leaders and other puppet kings, other false messiahs, you're hearing him say these things. And imagine the impact it would have on you. Hearing Jesus declare and then demonstrate himself to be the kind of shepherd, the kind of leader you desperately need, but have never before in your life experienced. Seems to me there might be a few of us today who need to hear these words from Jesus too. Who need to take comfort and find encouragement in the kind of leader, the kind of shepherd, the kind of king Jesus not only declares but has already demonstrated himself to be. And especially now, as our perpetual distrust of our leaders is at an all-time high, and understandably so, it's hard not to be skeptical when our political leaders make more promises than they can count, much less keep. It is hard not to be cynical when our religious leaders keep failing and falling and forcing the faithful to clean up the mess they leave behind by their feet of clay. It's hard not to be distrustful after those we've known and loved for years break our hearts with their selfish actions. These words from Jesus in John 10 are for anyone and everyone who's been let down by their leaders. Religious, political, or even parental. This message is for those who've been let down by their preacher. And preachers will let you down. I know a few. And we all preach better sermons than we live. It's a message for those who've been let down by their elders. And elders will let you down. I've worked with a few, and they all deserve just as much forgiveness, or require just as much forgiveness as they deserve respect. It's for those who have been let down by the religious community. And religious communities will let you down. They may not always be there when you need them the most. They may distance themselves from you. They may ostracize you as you grow and change and ask hard questions and tell uncomfortable stories. It's a message for those who've been let down by their politicians. And politicians will let you down. Enough said about that. And it's a message for those who've been let down by their parents. And parents will let you down. Some try their best. Some don't. And none of us get it right the whole time. This is a message for those of us who, like the man Jesus healed, have experienced skepticism, opposition, rejection, and abandonment from those who are supposed to be with and for us. But it's also an invitation to hear, just like the man Jesus healed, to hear the voice of Jesus, our good shepherd, our good, crucified, and resurrected shepherd, welcoming us, accepting us, receiving us, and calling us to follow him through the valley of the shadow of death and into the green pastures of abundant life now and eternal life forevermore. May we listen for his voice. May we hear it. And may we keep following Jesus, our good shepherd.